years ago, it was you meet all different kinds of people. And there's a, because we came from another fellowship, and so in every fellowship, you've got different folks that you look for, and one of those is the sensible, loving, cut to the chase, make you feel welcome person, and that one of those people for us was Peggy. Right away, Peggy made a point to invite us into her home. We would play dominoes and catchphrase and got to know other members of our fellowship. And then as the years have progressed, I have seen, we've had chats and talks, and I really appreciate Peggy's pragmatic and sensible approach to recovery, yet very loving and very generous heart. And I'll just say one thing is, you know, there have been times in my sobriety it hasn't been awesome, and where I've been, you know, out of work or whatever, and Peggy would occasionally shoot me a text, or just, hey, how's it going? That kind of thing. And I think what it reminds me is that 12-step work that we do by reaching out to other people and saying, I see you, I heard what you said, and I'm rooting for you, right? And Peggy has been one of those people that's been that way for me for years. So anyway, and by the way, when you meet her, you're gonna be like, she drank? Because she didn't, you know what I mean? You're just like, you're going like, I can't imagine, but you're about right. I've heard her story, you're gonna find out. So anyway, Peggy D.
Hi everybody, my name is Peggy D, and I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic. And so happy to be here. And so I want to start off by saying that today, as of this morning, I've been sober since Halloween night of 1982. And for every one of those days I have been sober, Alcoholics Anonymous has been there for me. I never did it on my own for a moment. I want to tell you why I'm wearing this shirt after looking and looking to find something to wear. I have two outfits since I retired. Summer outfit is a t-shirt and shorts. Winter outfit is blue jeans and the t-shirts. So it doesn't vary much. So I found this shirt, I love this shirt because for the last 12 years, and this is one of the benefits of sobriety, the last 12 years I have gone on a hiking trip to Big Bend with three gay men, and we play dominoes most of the time, we hike and we do meditative hikes, and we have meetings, and it is wonderful. And if you ever want to go camping or hiking or a long trip, take a gay man because they would bring tablecloths and really fancy food. Seriously, it's unbelievable. So it's me and the three of them, and we stay in a cabin, and we've been doing this for 12 years, and it's a huge part of my sobriety. So one of the things we talk about all the time that we need to remind ourselves of is Rule 62, particularly when we're playing dominoes. So another thing I want to mention right off is that I have a sponsor. I have several sponsees, and I'll say I have six of them because they contact me frequently. My sponsor, I met at Allendale, which is now my home group. I talk to her at least once a week. At 38 years sober, I talk to her more than I did the first 15 years to a sponsor. Now I see the benefit in not trying to figure out things on my own. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I don't like to spend a lot of time on what it was like. I like to be sober by 12:30. I think it's noon right now, or before. So I'm going to put my time a stopwatch on. Also, I made notes because I just turned 70 years old, and I'm 38 years sober. Woo! And so, if you want to hear something past the last 2 weeks of my life, I'm going to have to look at notes. Okay, the first thing I want to do is read the description. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, of you, me, all of us, if you're an alcoholic. And if you're not an alcoholic, and you want to start seeing what it's like, you can follow the prescription in this book I'm about to read. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us felt at times that we were regaining control, but at such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by less control, which led in time to pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced that that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period of time, we get worse, never better. And if you hang around Alcoholics Anonymous long enough, you will find that to be absolutely true. People who come into the program and then leave, they come back, they have never gotten better, and come back to let us know how good it got, and do we want to come follow in their path. Usually come in much worse than they did if they make it back. And that's part of the thing I really remember to hear, is if they make it back into the rooms. The first thing I want to talk about, my first recollection of the disease of alcoholism with me, does not involve alcohol. And the last thing that happened with me did not involve alcohol. That was part of the disease of alcoholism. And that thing that happened recently to me that was not part of the disease of alcoholism was that I got into a lot of fear about something that was going to happen. I got in a ton of fear. I forgot to pray. I didn't call my sponsor. I was totally self-reliant, just like I used to be when I was out drinking. So no, I didn't drink, but I got into this really bad space for about 5 hours, and thank God I remembered the tools of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why I still go to meetings, because I would be living there. The first symptom I had of alcoholism happened when I was about 7 years old. I was in the second grade. I was from a family. I was of five girls. I was the fourth girl down. We're all very close in age. We were post-World War II. And we lived in a really tiny house out in East Austin. So anyway, I went to school, and the school that I went to here in South Austin actually had a bathroom in between two of the rooms. And my sister was in the third grade on the other side of my room, and I was in the second grade. And I would go into that bathroom and curl up in a ball and start crying, and felt like something was horribly wrong with me. In our home, the parents didn't drink. We played a lot of games. We laughed a lot. We did not have a horribly dysfunctional home. I mean, everyone's home's got some dysfunction, but it was a pretty normal household, and all the other four sisters, none of them had these kind of symptoms but me. And the teacher would go get my sister, who was eight, from the other room, and get me out of the bathroom, and she would walk me home, and I would just be in tears, and my parents kept asking, "What's wrong?" And I did not have a word for what was happening with me. But it happened later in life, the more I drank, and the more I drank helped kill that feeling. So I didn't have that feeling all the time, but I had it frequently. And it's the void that we feel, I believe, as alcoholics, that we use a lot of alcohol to cover up. And alcohol really is a fix for that issue. It's a temporary one, we know where it leads. But so I started drinking heavily at the age of about 16, 17 years old. And by the time I was 31, I got sober when I was 31 years old. And I will tell you some of the pitiful, incomprehensible, demoralizing things that happened with me. And I won't stick a lot in those, because we all did them. Everyone sitting in this room, I think, can identify with those. One of the things I did was came home from, I had two daughters, and I was married. By the way, I was married and divorced twice to the same man. We got married when we were 19, and then we divorced, and I swore up and down I was sober. What I actually said, I never said I was sober, said I went to AA. And he assumed that meant I was sober, and I wasn't. And then I went to AA to get him off my back, and we got back together. And I figured if we got back together, of course I wouldn't want to drink, and of course I did, because it had nothing to do with him. So, and then he divorced me pretty quickly after that. But when my daughter was three, and the other daughter was, I think, one was two and one was four. I would ride my bicycle after he went to work. He worked at night. I would ride my bicycle to the convenience store with these two kids at home alone, and I would go get beer and come back. And one time I did this, and there was a fire truck outside my house, and I was just almost in a blackout and couldn't figure out what happened. My daughter, my little two-year-old, had stepped on a broken Coke bottle, and her foot was really bleeding, and the fire truck was there, and they were bandaging up her foot, and no one asked me, are you drunk? Where was the mom? Did you know you left the kids alone? One of the neighbors had had to call. The tragedy of that is back in the 70s, alcoholism was not addressed the same way that it is today, and neither was Child Protective Services, because I'll tell you, I really endangered those kids a lot and had no right to have custody of those kids or be left alone with those kids. And that wasn't the only time I endangered them. I slipped on the ice and had my tiny little baby daughter and fell on top of her. The list goes on and on. One of the worst things that happened too was that, I don't want to talk a lot about a lot of drug alarms. What I want to say is I woke up in a lot of blackouts, really ashamed, didn't know where my car was. One time after I swore up and down I had stopped drinking, my husband was trying to find me all over. We lived in South Austin. He was trying to find me everywhere, and because I left the kids alone and gone out drinking and swore up and down to him I wouldn't drink. He had the keys. I didn't have any money, anything, but you know us alcoholics can find a way, right? I went to a local bar, and I was sitting on the lap of a man who said he would buy me alcohol if I sat on his lap, and I did. And I drank a lot, and my husband walked in there, and it was just horrible. The look on his face was, that's not what he said. He was very, very upset, but I remember the look on his face, and after that, it went really downhill from there. It went from bad to worse. And right after that happened, for the next 2 months, I bottomed out in a way that I hope no one ever has to feel. The demoralization and horrible things that I felt and did. Okay, the week, let me see what time it is. It's 20 minutes. It's 8 minutes. Okay. Right before I got sober, two things happened in the same week, and I have not had a drink since. And the first thing that happened was I ended up in town late drinking a lot of alcohol. And ironically, I went to town late to do a fourth step, because I was going to meetings, but I never put more than 30 days together, and I thought maybe a fourth step might help. I went to town late to do a fourth step and ended up drinking instead. It just sounded a lot easier to me. And I passed out. And when I woke up, there was a woman up on the bank down from where I was laying. And I was covered in mud and reeked of alcohol and urine. I had a lot of empty beer cans around me. I'd taken a 12-pack down there and drank pretty much of the day. And I just remember a little boy yelling, "Mom, Mom, look." And she looked down at me, and I opened my eyes, and we kind of locked eyes, and she looked at me with utter disgust and horror, and she pulled her little boy away from me so he wouldn't look at me. And I really and truly wanted to say, "Wait, I have two kids. I'm in the PTA. I'm not what this looks like." And then I realized, really and truly, it was like, this is what I am. I am a drunk. It's in the middle of the day, and I am laying passed out in town late. This is who I am. And it doesn't matter what I say I am, it matters what I do that defines who I am today, not what my intentions are. The world was judging me by my actions, but my intentions were, I'll get sober. I'm gonna get sober pretty soon. This can't get any worse. 2 days later, I went to church with my husband after that happened. Well, right after that happened, and this woman locked eyes, I thought, I've got to go to a meeting. I can't go home like this. And I went to Bolden Street. And I want to tell this, it has a very good moral for me to it. But I sat next to this man at Bolden Street. And I had seen him there for a couple years. And his name was Andy. I actually met him later on in life in my sobriety, but his name was Andy, and he came over and he held my hand. And I had just gotten out of town, like, I mean, the back of my hair was just caked in mud, and my clothes were wet, and I couldn't even stand the way I smelled. So, am I doing okay, Rob? Am I showing that I really did? Okay. So, at Bolden Street, this man sat down next to me, and he held my hand, and he said, "You know what, I really love you." He said, "I hate our disease, but I love you." And no one had said that to me in such a long time. Looked in my eyes and said that genuinely. I mean, for a really, really long time. And I knew he meant it. And it just cut through something in me that just melted. And I didn't want to drink again. And I, 2 days later, went to church with my husband, and a woman in the program came up and talked to me and said, "I understand you have a problem with alcohol." She said, "Just do this, this, and this, and call me if you're going to have a drink. But don't call me after 10. Don't call me after you've been drinking." And I said, "Okay." I left church not armed with anything else, no phone numbers but hers. Back in that day, we didn't have cell phones, nor computers, nor smart TVs. Should I go on? So I went home, and I went to a party that I already agreed to go to that night. And it was way out somewhere in Manchester. And I wasn't going to drink. I was going to call her when I got home. And I drank because someone offered me a beer, and I drank. And the next thing I remember, and I was with my two kids, and this is somewhere, I mean, way out, like when you go to Manchac and go through Manchac and go down a bunch of country roads to get there, Manchac. And somewhere around 1 or 2 in the morning, I woke up in the hallway in my house. And I had been in a complete blackout. I don't know how I got back from that party, but I, again, endangered those two kids' lives driving in a total blackout from Manchac, Texas. We lived near Highland Mall, kind of. And I knew I couldn't do it again. I knew that this was over. I didn't want to ever do that again to my kids or me. And the next day I got up and I went to Northland. It used to be called Suburban when I lived there. I went to Suburban. And a woman came up to me, and she had been drinking. She and I had both been seeing each other in meetings for probably a year, but neither one of us had more than 30 days, ever put more than 30 days sober together, or maybe a week, I don't know. But she was there, and I asked her, I said, "You look really different." She said, "I haven't had a drink in, like, I think it was 3 months, if memory is right." Her eyes looked clear, and she looked bright. And I said, "Oh, will you be my sponsor? I've got to have a sponsor." And she said, "Yes, I don't recommend that, by the way. Get someone with more than 3 months with bright eyes." I mean, it worked, I'm still sober. But so this woman said, "Let's go out back. The first thing we're gonna do is go out back." They have a lawn out back in Northland. "And we're gonna do the third step prayer." And I argued with her, no, I don't believe in God. I'm not gonna do fakey things. And she said, "I didn't ask you, I told you, let's go." And I said, "Okay." And we went out with two other guys that I would never normally have mixed with. And we went out and we held hands and we knelt and we did the third step prayer. And my life has never been the same after that. Not because I had a spiritual awakening, but because I was willing to do something someone else told me to do. And thought, "Oh, she's sober and I'm not. I'm going to do it." And that is one of the essences of our program. It doesn't matter a damn if you think it's a good idea. If someone suggests it, just do it. I mean, seriously, do it. We don't have good ideas when we come into Alcoholics Anonymous. We really don't. And I have not had a drink since that day, and that was Halloween. That was November 1st of 82. I will move on. Now I am sober, and it is 14 minutes, yay. So, I was still married, I had the two kids, and I was sober and didn't know what the hell I was doing and how to do any of it. I was completely in a fog and overwhelmed. So someone who tells their story and says, "And then I got a sponsor that day, and they started working with me through the steps, and we did we went to the fourth step." It's like, no, that did not happen for me. And I'm not saying someone did the program wrong or I did the program wrong. I was in too much of a fog to even begin to know how to look at my character defects or anything else. I was struggling to figure out how to make dinner for those kids when they got home from school and how I was going to get employment. And the first 5 years were about being in a fog, getting a divorce, and coming out. And it was very painful, and I don't remember that much of the first 5 years. I remember a lot of, I mean, it's been a long time ago. I remember a lot of it, but I remember just clinging on and doing all the stuff I could do. And that same woman that told me to do the, kneel down and do the third step prayer, she also told me that every day before my feet hit the floor to do the first three steps. And I really, I think it's a really good idea. I think it's a great idea to get up and do some kind of a discipline every day. Because we don't know how to do disciplines. At least I didn't. I had no discipline, no habits. I had a lot of disciplines and habits that were all bad habits. They were all about me getting what I needed and what I wanted. So when I woke up sober, I suddenly had these kids and this husband I needed to care about, and I didn't know how. And doing that third step, at least doing the first three steps every morning and developing that habit, kept me sober enough to learn. Alcoholics Anonymous will teach you how to do those things you don't know how to do yourself. I mean, I promise if you stick around, if you're overwhelmed, if you come sober, you wake up sober and you've got kids and you've got a whole train, a train wreck behind you and you don't know what to do, just do one day at a time, 1 hour at a time and keep coming around. I swear we'll give you the solutions. I can offer solutions now because I'm not, I know how to do it. So, okay, this is where I check my notes because this is where my memory fogs out. Okay. So, between 5 and 10 years sober was when I really started coming awake and alive. I got a job in the tech industry, only back then it wasn't really the tech industry, it was in the 80s. I got a job in the tech industry, but it was not computers, and really started loving the job, and I went to work every single day. And part of Alcoholics Anonymous taught me, part of what you guys taught me was that just because it's not fun, get the hell up and go to work. We don't care if you want to go have a job. We don't care, you know, nobody cares about that. Get up and go do responsible stuff. And I started acting like an adult, and pretty soon I started doing adult things. I got a driver's license for the first time in my life, although I had been driving for many, many years. I really had this attitude because I was back in the 60s. You know, I was living back, I was growing up in the 60s, and it was like, oh, I'm not getting a driver's license. That's a, you know, that's the man making us do this stuff. And, I got a driver's license because my company wanted to send me somewhere and mentioned a driver's license, I think, and I had to go get one. So, and I also got a checkbook and did some other things that were adult things to do. I don't know if anybody else got sober and really and truly was like a teenager, but honestly, my daughter, who was 12 years old, was more mature than me because she picked up all the pieces as I was drinking. She became the adult in the house, and she was more mature than me. And I can tell you, the one thing for years and years in sobriety that I heard, when we read the promises all the time, and we say we will not regret the past, and we wish to shut the door on it, I have to say it's taken me years. I still twinge when I think about those girls. It's taken me years to forgive myself and to be okay with what I did to those girls. It really has been. I was gonna say, well, I never physically abused them, but I think emotional abuse and never mind. Oh, that's another whatever group. Here's how I got past, here's how I came to a point of forgiveness. I'll tell you what about the girls and acceptance. I will tell you what I didn't do, because it didn't work. I didn't sit in my room on my bed praying and writing everything bad I did, please God forgive. That never worked. I tried it. What I did was I went and sponsored people who had kids, women who had kids, and said, I can never forgive myself because I did X, Y, and Z to my kids. And I would look at them honestly and say, you can forgive yourself. Of course you can forgive yourself. You have a disease of alcoholism, and it doesn't give you a free ride to be a horrible parent, but you did those things when you had a really bad disease. You can forgive yourself. And I would talk them through it and work with them. And pretty soon, guess what? I was forgiving myself for that same thing. Every time I told somebody, no, you really can forgive yourself for doing that, then I was forgiving myself too. The other day, my daughter said to me, and I have a very close relationship with both my girls and my ex-husband, and by the way, and my daughter said to me, Mom, you're just the best mom in the world, and I'm always wanting to say, oh, but I, and I clam my mouth shut, and don't say that. And it's not like, oh, she wants to believe that, I'm not going to remind her. It's like, thank you. Thank you that you even have a relationship with me. Thank you, God. And I thank God all the time that I did not get what I deserved. I have two grandkids I get to see. My daughter leaves me with those grandkids. Alone. And I've taken them on trips and everything. The word grace, for years I have said, by the grace of God, I recently saw what the word grace means. And I'm in two groups with my sponsor a week. One of them is a 12 and 12 study, and the other one is an emotional sobriety. We go through the emotional sobriety book, and we have a group with like five or six people. It's mostly old ladies that are retired. So, or I would invite all of you to come. But it looks like anyone here is going to really. So in that book, it says grace is, this woman was talking about grace and how she didn't get what she deserved. And it is, I swear to God, I just totally forgot it. It basically is undeserved love from God. And the word is not undeserved, but it's something, it's a word like that. But it's like you get this stuff even though you don't deserve it. And then you give it to other people, or you can't hang on to it. You can't keep it. We don't come in here and then grab this stuff and, oh, everybody, thanks a lot, I'll see you later, thanks for helping me get sober. No. We keep coming around, and then when somebody new comes into the door, we say, how can I help you stay sober? Oh, you say you have kids and you don't know what to do, you can't go to meetings? Well, this is what I did. And you go on and on, you go to any lengths, not just to get it, we go to any lengths to keep this thing. And if you think it gets easier when you're 38 years sober, it has gotten a lot easier, but the problems I've got, I still have problems. That was not a good experience, drinking milk, was it? You don't think it gets easier at 38? It's like, well, it's not really. It does get much easier, and life is grand at 38 years sober. So, I want to go back to the 5 and 10. We kind of go do this a little bit chronologically. Because the important thing here is that I didn't just go through 38 years of sobriety without a ton of work to get to where I am today, which is sober another day. I had to do, I sponsored a lot of people, and I still do. I went to a lot of meetings, and I still do. And by, one day at a time, my life was just getting better. I was living with two teenage girls by now, and if you think that's easy, it's really, really not. Teenage girls, that was really tough. Raising them through their teenage years. And I just talked to other women that had teenage kids. Or men that had teenage kids. So, when I was about 9 years sober, my life really changed a lot. That's when my sobriety really, really took off. For one thing, I met the woman of my dreams. And we have been married. We've been together now for 30 years this August. It's been a real struggle. It has been a struggle, and it has been a lot of joy and a lot of growth. The other thing was that I got I got a job that I prayed and prayed for. And praying and praying for something for me is something I don't do anymore. I mean, I literally do not do that. I prayed and I got that job. And the job was working on this project, a government project called the Superconductor Super Collider. And it was going to be built up in Waxahachie. And I was hired among 25 other people in Texas to go up for this training for this project. And the whole assumption was it was going to be a really diverse group of people. And they wanted a bunch of women and a bunch of men. Of the 25, it was going to be half women, half men. It was going to be people of color, people from all walks of life. I get there the first day, up in New York. The training was in New York for 9 months, and then we came back and worked here. I got up to that training. There were 24 men, maybe one black man, African-American man, a few men of Hispanic men, me, and they were all devout. Well, they were all of a religious variety, but I was not. And talk about uncomfortable for 9 months. Oh my gosh. And there was no way I was going to come out either as an alcoholic or a lesbian to them. One of the things they told us first off is we're going to be seeing a lot of those kind in New York. You've got to run the other way. Just ignore. Just don't engage. Don't go anywhere near Fire Island. If you're straight, you don't know what Fire Island is. It's a kind of a gay place. I mean, they really did like warn me, like just don't go near there. And I thought, where is it? How do you get there? And so anyway, I did that. And about once a week, I would say, never pray for your own, you know, don't pray for specific things. Don't pray for specific things. And I don't say that now because you might get a bad job. You might get a job that didn't turn out quite the way you thought. But because of the 11th step states otherwise. That's why I don't do it now. We don't pray for our own personal selfish ends. We pray for the knowledge of God's will and the power to carry it out, period. Stop. There's not a comma. Unless, no. Stop, that's it. And when I do that, God, life is good. Because then I know as I'm going along through the days, this is how it's supposed to be, and I'm out of the way, I'm over here on the footwork committee, and my higher power is on the results committee. I don't want to be on the results committee anymore of my life. I really don't. So what I did when I was in New York, though, for the solution, was I looked up meetings and I went I took the train into New York and went to meetings. And the guys that were there with me, the other 24, never once wanted to go to the city with me because they had been warned that, well, for one thing, if you have any jewelry on, like a ring, somebody's gonna come up behind and chop your finger off and paint it. And I mean, they were just like, people, come on. It was kind of a small-minded kind of a, you know, situation. And so I would go into the city all the time and go to meetings. I connected with some gay lesbian people, GLBT community, out in Long Island, where I lived for 9 months. And it actually taught me a lot. It taught me acceptance of other people. It taught me just to get up and still go to work every day because I signed up. And I thank God for this job, and I got this job, and by God, I'm going to do this job, and I'm going to do it to the best of my ability. I don't want to whine about it. And so that's what I did. Came home in a year, and I got laid off from that job. Everybody did, because they cut the funding for that project. So we all got laid off, and lo and behold, then started my whole career. I got a job at a computer company that I don't ever say the name of, but I can see their diamond right over there. Their diamond right over there somewhere. But I got a job there, and I worked there for almost 24 years. And I can tell you it was the coolest thing. Because once I really got it in my head that I was at that job to do service work, period. I wasn't there to make money. I wasn't there to get famous. I wasn't there to do anything but service work. And when I really started looking at it, I mean, I wanted a paycheck, of course, like we all do, but that wasn't the means. That wasn't why I was there. When I really started seeing it, I'm there to do service work. Who can I help? The most miraculous things started happening because I stopped being on my little footwork committee. And what's going to happen to me? And what am I going to get? And what am I going to get out of this? And where am I going to go? And when am I going to get a raise? And hey, she made supervisor. I wanted to make supervisor. I've been here just like we all do, right? And when I focused on, oh my God, I am sober today by the grace of God. And I have got a job. And these people at this job at Dell gave me the opportunity to travel. And I traveled all over the world for many years there. And it was the coolest thing. I mean, I remember on my first trip, I went to Ireland. And I was on the plane going to Ireland, and I was scared to death, and I was thinking, God, in the past, people wouldn't give me keys to a car to drive to Waco. These people gave me a credit card, you know, and bought me a plane ticket and said, you know, we need you to go to Ireland. Would you go to Ireland to support this, their factory over there? And I said, yeah. And I got off the plane, and suddenly I had that fear, that same fear right here in my gut. I had when I used to go into the bathroom, back when I used to drink, to make that go away, I had that fear came over me. It was like, I don't know anyone here. What am I doing? Why did I tell them I would do this? Well, I called Intergroup. The guy answered the phone, and I asked where a meeting was. He could not understand a word I was saying. And I could not understand a word he was saying. And we talked for maybe 5 minutes. But he could tell I was crying and I was upset. And he said something that I understood. And he said, he's a wired here. And I said, Dell, or sorry, that computer company. And he said, Geraldine Ryan. Geraldine Ryan. Look for Geraldine Ryan. So So the next day I go there to my work assignment, and who in the world should meet me but Geraldine Ryan? And she was not called or informed or anything. She was the person I connected with. And I was just amazed. And so it started a friendship that has lasted, I don't know, that's been 30, I don't know how many years ago, 94, however many years that is. It's been a friendship that has lasted all these years. We have met at the conferences, at the international conferences. I went to Ireland a few years ago to visit her. I absolutely love this woman. She's come here and she went to meetings at Allendale with me. And we were supposed to meet at the international conference last year, but you know what happened to that. And if you didn't, you maybe are just newly sober, but everything was shut down last year because of COVID, so we couldn't go anywhere. And that's okay. I mean, I was in a fog too when I got sober. I could have been drunk through COVID and not know it. So this friendship was just so great, and she took me to meetings all over, and she would always sit there and say, did you hear what he said? Did you understand? I would say, no. And she would decipher everything for me. So that was one of the coolest things. And it was like, I didn't say, God, please let help me meet someone sober. I was just like, let me go there and be a service work too, wherever I go. I want to say one thing I thought was so cool when I went to the facility, to their factory. Just about everybody in Limerick, Ireland worked at this factory. And I went in there. And in the factory, in the facility here in Austin, you go in and there's all of these closed-in, locked-off places where people go put their coats and their purse and their whatever else, all their personal items, and they're locked up. I went over there, went into the ladies' room. It's real big and it has like all the coats hanging in there, all the coats, all the purses, everything in there, just out for anybody. Because their culture was just so much different than ours. And anyway, I loved Ireland. I cried when I left Ireland. I wanted to go back, and I was afforded the opportunity to go back several times. So, and I also went to a lot of other places that were, I don't know, I loved going to places and finding a meeting. So by and by, I worked in the same team at Dell for almost 20 years. At first I worked in a server development lab, And then I ended up working in the events committee, and they're very two different jobs. I was a technical support in the events committee. And so I would go and do all the technical stuff at all these events that we have worldwide. And it was such a trip. So I worked on the same team, the same women. And we became very, very close, all of us. And to this day, we're very close. I was closer to them and spent more time with them in airports all over the world and working all night and everything than I've spent with anybody during my life. So I remember at one point my partner, Bunny, her name is Bunny. Okay, so Bunny always alluded that I was going on a vacation. She was a school teacher. I was going on a vacation. She was going to go teach school, so one of us was having fun, and life was a vacation, a holiday, and one was working. So I said, I tell you what, go with me on this trip. I'm going to Berlin. Go with me. And she said, I would love to. We got there, and she said, when you're done working, can you meet me, and we'll go to dinner like at 7? And I said, oh, no. I am not going to be done working at 7. You go to dinner, and we have to all work together until this thing is all done, all set up. We were done at 5 a.m. At 5 a.m., I went to the room, and she wakes up and said, oh, why are you up so early? And I said, I'm just coming to bed, and I've got to take a shower and get dressed and go right back out there, and now we have to do the stuff we're here, you know, now we've got to do the event. She never again said, you're on vacation. Never. And the glory of it was that we were given the freedom to then stay at wherever we went if we wanted for several days and, you know, traipse around. And I had a lot of fun. But I also put in a lot of work. Okay, wait, no, I'm missing. Okay. Now, that's about the job. So now I want to talk about, let me see how much time. Oh, 37 minutes. Okay, I have 20 minutes, I think, right? 20 minutes? Okay. One of the things I learned in AA was how to be honest. And the way to be honest is very simple. Stop lying.
Yes.
No, stop lying. Because I wanted my sponsor to sit down with me, tell me how can I be honest. She said, we don't need to go sit down anywhere. Just stop lying.
Yes.
Okay. And everything in the program is very simple like that. If you want long-winded explanations, okay. If you want simplicity, that has always been the key for me. I can hear that. Don't lie. Oh, then pretty soon I have it like I'm honest. Now, I'll talk about some hard things now. During my sobriety, I've had some real challenges. Some things happened, but they didn't happen to me. And I used to couch this. This happened to me. Two of my sisters died. This happened to me. And now, and later on in sobriety, I realized that didn't happen to me. That happened to them. I was in their life there to support, and I actually was able to be there for both of my sisters a day before they died. They were not in Austin, so I had to fly out. I flew out to where they were, but I flew out frequently. They both died of cancer. They both died when they were 43 years old. And my little sister, it was a lot harder than the older one. But I'll tell you, I was able to go out where they were, be in the room with them, and be comforting. Do you realize that a lot of us alcoholics, it's like, oh, it's too much. Let somebody else go in and comfort. I just can't watch someone that's sick. And you know what? You gotta just go in there and do it. This is about becoming a grown-up. And getting over ourselves, getting over our cheeks off, like I like to say, getting over ourselves and going and doing some things that are very, very uncomfortable. I would say a prayer, I would ask God to walk into the room before me, and I would go in there, and I didn't ever say, oh, you're gonna get better, or any of that BS. I went in and prayed with them, or I went in and talked to them. And then I would go to somewhere else and sob and cry. It was not with them. When my little sister died, I was devastated for a long, long time around that and felt so bad. And my other two sisters, I still have the other two sisters, and the five of us remained very, very close all during our adult lives. My two remaining sisters live in New Mexico, and I lived there for a long time as well as an adult. But we decided that one of the things, instead of crying all the time about the sisters, let's do something. Because I called them and I said, I want to do something as a solution. Because AA taught me that you can either focus on the problem or on the solution. You can't focus on both. You can bounce back and forth and go crazy. And, you know, maybe grab a drink or maybe go to a meeting, you know, toss a coin. I asked my sisters if we could focus on the solution by doing an Avon walk. And an Avon back, I don't know if they still do it, but an Avon walk is where you raise money for breast cancer by doing a 60-mile walk and from one location, like one city to the next. They had it all over the U.S., and we chose the Boulder to Denver 60 miles. And I can tell you that was the most healing thing after my sisters died to do that. If you have lost loved ones, you can cry and cry, but one of the things to do as a solution is feel like, for me, felt like I was doing something to help that disease so that other people, you know, maybe somebody else might be helped. So we got our, we went on the hike, we went on the walk, the 60-mile walk, and what happened for me on that walk was so much more than raising money for breast cancer. Part of it was that, one of my sisters is obese, and I was real worried about her walking. And she would, so we walked pretty slow for her, and I didn't care. We walked 20 miles for 3 days, and we slept in a tent at night. And on the third day, she said, I can't do this anymore. She said, my feet are, I can't make it. And she said, and there was a van that would come around and pick up anybody who couldn't walk anymore, you know, who just was too tired. And there was 4,000 of us people, of us women and men and children walking. And she said, I can't do this anymore. And she said, I'm gonna get the sweep van to take me back. And my sister Laura and I said, okay, well then we're all gonna go back with you. And she said, no, you guys finish the walk. And we said, nope, we're staying together. We're gonna stay together. We had a big banner that had our sisters' names on there, Jenny and Billy. It was just so cool. It was just an amazing thing. So she said, no, I'm gonna walk. And the other thing that happened on that, so she walked all the way to the Broncos Stadium in Denver. We all walked into that stadium together. And her feet were black and swollen up, and I was so proud of her. But the other thing that happened during that walk, we were maybe in the day two of it, I don't know. But this woman came walking by real fast. And she looked over at me and she said, are you a friend of Bill's? Because I had this necklace on. I said, yeah, because I was walking slow with the sister. And she was, and she said, can we get the serenity prayer? And I said, sure. And so we held hands right in the middle of all these, you know, thousands. We held hands and we said the serenity prayer together. And then kind of like side hug, because she was in a big hurry. And said, well, thanks, thanks. And I just wanted to cry, and my sister said, we want to do that. We want to get to do that. That was so cool. I said, okay, so the three of us held hands and did the serenity prayer. And it was just, I mean, it was just very touching. So we got to the stadium, 4,000 people, and everybody who was a breast cancer survivor went into one side of the stadium and put a pink shirt on, and everybody who was a supporter, like me and my sisters, went into another side of the stadium and put a blue shirt on. And when I saw the amount of women, and men actually, who were walking, who had had breast cancer, or had breast cancer at the time, I burst into tears so hard, I cried for days. Because we were walking all together. I had no idea when we were walking. You know, and we went to the tent at night, and there were people struggling. And it was amazing. And I always like to remember how many of those people in that crowd, we said, hey, who wants to just not have breast cancer for one day at a time by going to a meeting, hanging out with people, drinking some coffee? Would that be something you'd be willing to do to get over this disease, have it in remission? Would there be one person there that did not raise their hand? You know, you don't have to do chemo again. You don't have to do any of this crap. You know, so I just, you know, I cannot tolerate, I have to say, people who will whine to me about what we have to do. It's like, for Christ's sake, is your life any better than you walked out of the hellhole you were living in? How dare us, any of us, really, complain? oh, I've got to go meet a sponsee. Oh, I've got to call my sponsor. No, it's a meeting on gratitude. Oh, talk about the hell you, talk about your life before you stop drinking then. I mean, it just amazes me. It's amazing. So, talk about the last thing, because I think my time is just, Okay, so the last thing I would talk about was that 2 years, the last 2 years of my life, because I took a turn in the last 2 years, literally. So what happened, and this has been happening to me, by the way, in honesty. So I went to Arkansas to go and hunt for crystals in a crystal mine. They have them all over Arkansas. And the second or third day I was there in a crystal mine, I fell. And I'll just leave it at this and say my foot became almost detached from my leg. It was gross. While I was falling, my foot got caught in a rock, and my rest of my body kept tumbling downhill. And when I saw that thing, I don't watch violence on TV. I can't stand the sight of blood. It was horrible. But the worst thing about it, and I had to get a helicopter for $38,000. I later found out when I got the bill. The helicopter had to come and airlift me out to a hospital in Hot Springs. And the worst thing of that entire ordeal was that they gave me morphine. And when they gave me morphine, as soon as I got under the influence of that, I totally lost conscious contact with God. I mean, I could feel it, and I was terrified. I honest to God, was terrified. I felt like I was free falling. And some people think, oh, you got to have morphine. It's like, it was a nightmare beyond nightmares. And I could not wait for that stuff to wear off. And so the next day I had, it wore off eventually. I don't remember when or any of that, but I had surgery there in Hot Springs. And I came back to Austin and had another surgery, but I want to tell you about my homecoming to Austin. We had driven my Subaru there and I could not lay down in the back of that Subaru for money to drive me home. I had to have a much larger thing. I had to lay down. I had these metal rods going all through my legs, holding my leg together. And so I called Stuart and asked him, he said, what can I do? Stuart's somewhere in the room and I won't point him out. So I called Stuart and said, what can I do? And I said, can you get me a couple of guys to help me get out of my car when I get home? Because Bunny's not going to be able to get me into the house, and I can't walk. And so meanwhile, then I called my sisters. They live in New Mexico. And they said, what can I do? And I said, I don't have a way to get home. We gotta figure out a way to get home. And they have a van. They drove all the way from Albuquerque, New Mexico to Hot Springs to pick me up. And all I remember is they walked in my hospital room and burst into tears when they saw me. And so we drove home, my sisters drove me home, and when I got home, and we got held up in the traffic real badly, I got home at 11 o'clock at night, and we were praying that Stuart had stayed there, you know, that somebody could help, because I just couldn't move. Turned around the corner and there were 15 guys there, and more than just Stuart in that room. Another guy I'm looking at back here that was there. I will never forget that in my life. Alcoholics Anonymous, I mean, these guys all lifted me into the house. There were all these people there. They had porta potties, they had a wheelchair, they had walkers. They had all the stuff a person would need who was healing from a, you know, serious thingy like that. And you know, the I didn't have much pain. I didn't have to take painkillers. Took Tylenol 3 for a few days, and that was that. And I was going to say, and then the irony of that is I really don't have a lot of feeling from my knee down, so it's not surprising. But I wasn't in a lot of pain. And then my friend David, who's also in the room, would come and pick me up and take me to meetings. And he put on special old lady music just for me. Turned off the rock stuff and put on like the Carpenters and the Beatles and, you know. And I mean, it was just all this stuff people do, you know, when you say, can you help? Just, you know, if I had been too proud, when Stuart said, is there something I can do? If I had been too proud to say, yeah, I really need help, or told David, yeah, I need a ride to a meeting, I would never have done any of this stuff. I mean, I don't know what would happen. I don't want to know. What I do know is that when we ask for help, people are all too happy to help. And you know why we like to help is we get out of ourselves when we help. We totally get out of ourselves. And I will never forget the kindness that Alcoholics Anonymous did for me when I got injured. And my foot's all swell now. I walked 7 miles the other day. I was really worried I wouldn't be able to walk again. I was really, but then I thought, on the other hand, I am so steeped in gratitude. It's been so pushed into my head, and I do so many gratitude lists. I thought, I have had 68 years of getting to walk. You know, if I can't walk after this, you know, I'll, so be it. I really did. I came to terms with it, and the doctor here in Austin, I had to have two more surgeries here in Austin, said to me, why in the world did you think you couldn't walk? You know, with all the modern medicine we have. Sure enough. So, I am really, really so grateful beyond words to be sober. And this incredible life, let me make sure I didn't leave something significant out. Do I have any more time?
A couple minutes, yeah.
Huh?
A couple minutes.
Okay. No, I mean, I've covered most of the stuff, and anything else is just a story, and I don't need to tell a story. What I want to leave you with, though, is please get into the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous however you can. If you think you're marginalized and on the side and you don't have any friends, then start going up to people after meetings and say, hi, my name is whatever your name is. Hi, I'm Peggy. Don't say I'm Peggy. You go up to people and you say, hi, I'm Peggy. What's your name? How are you doing? And if that's awkward because you don't know what to say, then don't say anything. Ask them questions. People will answer your questions. They want to talk about themselves. That's all you got to do. Seriously, I learned that very early on. Go up and talk to people. Ask them questions. Oh, I heard you say so-and-so when you shared in the meeting. How long have you been sober? What area of town do you live in? Now, during the days of PC, of course, there's a whole thing of questions you can't ask any longer, so it may be challenging now, but go up and just ask questions. And you know, hey, would you like to go have some coffee? And it's so vitally important. And I want to remember that guy that came up to me when I went to that meeting of Bolden that time. And sat down next to me and he said, I love you. And no one else came near me because I reeked of alcohol and was all muddy and gross looking. And you know what? We can't afford to do that with people. We can't afford to look at people and decide that they're not worth saving or not worth talking to and run over to our friends to catch up on what we did on the weekend. We have got to go and shake hands with these people and welcome them. Because I wouldn't be up here today, probably, had I not been welcomed into Alcoholics Anonymous. And so that's our duty and responsibility. And if you get some joy and fun during the way, then great. But we've got to give back what we have been so freely given. And that's how the program works. I am so, so happy that you all are here and you're sober today. And this could be a good memory day, you know, staying sober. So thank you all.